Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 198 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Jane Rogoiska speaks with Frances Burns about being drawn to her father's homeland of Poland, telling hidden stories from that country's brutal history, and how the frustrations of film production drove her to writing.
Jane Rogoiska's father was a boy when he came to England from Poland, fleeing the Nazis. War-torn Europe has been one feature of Jane's writing. For example, she's written a biography of the Polish photographer Gerda Taro, who was killed whilst working as a photojournalist in the Spanish Civil War. And Jane's first novel is written from the point of view of a Polish doctor who's been taken prisoner by the Soviets in World War II. She's worked in a number of different media, often in film, writing screenplays, directing original shorts as well as corporate videos, always looking for historical stories that resonate with her and for the best way to tell them. Jane graduated from Cambridge with a degree in modern languages but couldn't speak her father's tongue, so during the political turmoil of the late 1980s, she set off to discover more about her Polish background with a grant to study theatre in Warsaw.
I initially travelled to Poland out of an interest in looking at my roots, because my father's Polish, but I had been brought up not speaking Polish and entirely disconnected from any sense of the Polish community. My father had come to Britain as a child, so my mother's British, so we'd never really had any connection with it. I had done a degree in languages, and languages had always interested me, so I wanted to learn Polish. And I travelled out there at a very interesting time, which was the fall of communism. So it was the first post-communist year. And I had a grant to study theatre school. And it was while I was in Warsaw that I came in contact with students who were attending the Polish film school in Łódź. And I think it was about that time that I became interested in film. As I said, I started off with an interest in theatre, but I think found theatre as a form just not visual enough. I was very drawn to forms that were visually powerful. Film had always been, to me, something that seemed inaccessible. It was, for me, it was Hollywood. It wasn't something that someone from Britain could do. And going to Poland was the first time that I met people who were like me, who were studying film and who made films, and suddenly it opened up a world of possibilities, because Polish filmmaking is rooted in a kind of authorial, quite artistic style rather than a Hollywood style, which had never appealed to me. I then applied to film school in Britain, went to the Northern School of Film in Leeds, and they had an exchange programme running with the Polish film school. And so I studied in Leeds and then went back to Poland and spent a year and a half in Łódź.
What year are we talking about when you first go?
When I first went, it was 1989 to 90, and when I went back to Poland to the film school, it was 1994 to 5.
And so the pull of Poland, how had it been given to you if it wasn't talked about at home? Was it just sort of haunting?
I don't know. I think a lot of people that I know who studied languages seem to have in common a fact that they were obsessed with travelling, were not content with staying in their own country, wanted to go off and explore. And I was very much, when I was younger, that was me. I really, all I wanted to do was be somewhere other than the United Kingdom and to travel as much as I possibly could. So I spent a lot of my 20s travelling. I think the interest in Poland was part of that, and it was partly just a desire to get to know where my father had come from. I think a lot of people who come from a mixed background are interested in those roots, and I couldn't really explain why it is that one finds one's foreign side more interesting than one's British side, but perhaps it's because it's less known and it's less familiar. You know, when I was in Poland, I certainly didn't feel any particular affinity, in the sense I felt incredibly British, actually, being there, and still do. And if it teaches you anything, perhaps it teaches you to be more content with your own country. The years that I spent travelling really in the end taught me to appreciate what I liked about Britain.
How does the storytelling start happening? So it's immediately screenplays, it's immediately film.
No, I don't. Although I've always written, I don't think I saw myself as a writer for a very long time, and I'd always had this pull to direct. I didn't feel I was a natural storyteller. Probably still don't. I'm not somebody who invents stories. And what I've learnt through experience and my practice is I've learnt that I like to find existing stories and work with them. And that has become a big part of how I write and what's made me happy and fulfilled as a writer. The Gerda Taro story, I think Gerda Taro was, in a way, the gate towards me understanding that historical stories and historical research was something that really could underpin my work, that was a way of balancing my love of writing and my love of drama and storytelling with a sense that I wasn't someone who produced my own stories. I think someone gave me a little article about Robert Capa and his girlfriend Gerda Taro, and it was such a romantic story, and it started off as a screenplay. For ages we didn't do anything about it, because there's always been someone making a film about Capa somewhere. No one's ever actually made one yet, but there's always someone who's just announced that it's about to be made, so you go, oh, I better not do that. That it seems to be one of those projects that's kind of jinxed, a bit like Don Quixote, that there are certain stories that someone's always trying to make it into a film, and then it just hasn't happened. And I started researching it, and the story of Gerda Taro just combines so many things that I love. I love photography, and so to be able to tell a story about photography is just such a joy. I became completely obsessed with the Spanish Civil War, as anyone who starts researching it inevitably does. And of course it's a romantic story as well. There's a fabulous romance between Gerda Taro and Robert Capa. So to me it was just such a perfect, wonderful opportunity to tell that story. And it started as a screenplay and then became a book, and then someone else made it into a theatre play. So it's existed in lots of different forms.
And how do you know where to begin it?
Her story?
Yeah, in the telling of it.
The telling of it.
In the different forms.
Oh, well, it's a good question. You don't. It's really difficult to know when to start. So with the book, it was chronological, except that the editor, the very first thing he said was, take the end chapter and put it at the beginning. So we started with her death and then told her life. The screenplay has to focus on a much shorter time period, because obviously action in film is at its best when it's concentrated in time. You know, a biopic always suffers from the kind of weighty literalism that happens when you tell someone's life story and you want to tell it from the beginning to the end. You know, the good thing about Gerda Taro was she died very young. It's a dreadful thing to say, but she died very young. She had a very short career. So at least you're not dealing with that awful idea of someone, you know, you've got to tell someone's life up until they're 70 or something. That sounds very callous. But but in dramatic terms, the love story with Capa and her career as a photographer was the main focus. And that fitted into very neatly into a period of a couple of years. And so that became the focus of the screenplay. The whole thing about Gerda Taro was that for many years she was completely obscured by Capa, and that wasn't his fault, it was just what happened, that she fell into complete obscurity and was either not known at all or was only known as Capa's girlfriend. And so there's been this whole process of bringing her back out of the shadows, establishing which photographs are hers and which were Capa's. And that's been a whole process of scholarly research that's been done at the ICP in New York, which was facilitated by this extraordinary find of a cache of negatives, which is rather romantically called the Mexican suitcase, where they rediscovered a whole load of Spanish Civil War photographs by Capa and Taro, which enabled them to start identifying which were her photographs and which were his.
This is a fabulous thing, isn't there, about the discovery that gives you the whole world?
Yes, there's always a key. There's always a key. I've just finished a book, actually. So I've just finished a book that's about the 1940 Katyn massacre.
So can you describe what the massacre is?
The Katyn massacre is a fairly notorious Stalinist crime. What happened was during the Second World War, in the second week of September 1939, the Soviet Union invaded Poland from the east. So the Germans had invaded from the west, and then the Soviet Union invaded from the east, and they took a lot of Polish soldiers prisoner, hundreds of thousands of them. Whereas they released the non-commissioned officers and the privates back to Poland, they kept the officers in a series of NKVD, who were the Russian secret police, camps across the Soviet Union. There were 14,500 of them in these camps, of whom around 14,000 were murdered in April and May 1940. It's known as the Katyn massacre because in 1943 the bodies of the men who'd been murdered from one of the camps were discovered in the Katyn forest near Smolensk. They were found by the Germans, in fact, and for many years the crime was blamed on the Nazis and was completely denied by the Soviet government until the collapse of communism. The reality is that only one third of the prisoners' bodies were found in 1943, and the remaining ones were not discovered until 1990, when the official documents were handed over to the Polish government by Gorbachev, and when they finally said that it was a Soviet crime and they revealed the burial places of the remaining officers.
And this is your first novel?
Yes.
So how did that happen? Why did you take it to novel rather than screenplay?
I never thought it could be a screenplay. It's such an enormous subject. Although Andrzej Wajda made a film about the Katyn massacre, the film Katyn, I actually felt that the film suffered enormously from the problems that I encountered, which is that the story is at its most interesting when you have the full perspective of history to examine it with, and that perspective requires the 50-year interval before the truth was told. And the resonance is created by decades of lies and suppression. So when I first started researching it, I had a very specific aim in mind, which is that my purpose in writing it had derived from the accident that happened in 2010, when there was an air crash in Smolensk and a plane that was carrying a large section of very high-ranking Poles who were on their way to a commemoration of the Katyn massacre. The plane crashed just outside Smolensk and all these people were killed, and it was a kind of horrible, tragic echo of the fact that here was an elite group of Poles going to commemorate a massacre of an elite group of Poles. The thing that I was struck by was the fact that actually in Britain, many, many people were completely unaware of what the Katyn massacre was, and my own knowledge of it was fairly minimal, and particularly younger people had no idea what it was. And I was really interested in telling this story for a British audience, for a non-Polish audience, an audience who were not academics or historians. And when I first started working on it, I really wasn't sure whether it was going to be non-fiction or fiction. I had a sort of inkling that it might end up being fiction, but I was very frightened because I'd never written a novel, so I was very nervous about going down that route. But that's where I ended up.
One of the things in the chapter you sent me that I really noticed was it was in the present tense. You're writing in the present tense, and I wondered if that was something you couldn't let go of from screenplays.
Yes. I did experiment with different tenses. The present tense came out of it for two reasons. One, exactly because that's how I feel natural writing, because I come from a filmy background where you write everything in the present tense. And whenever I started trying to write in the past tense, I just got stuck. So even though I would have no objection if I had to go through the whole book and put it in the past tense, that was how I felt natural writing. The way that the book is structured is about one man's experience of history. And what I've tried to do is I've tried to create a story that's told from the point of view of the protagonist, who is experiencing it in real time, in the sense that he doesn't have the context of history. So he's a participant in the events, and he starts off as a very young man and he finishes the book as a very old man. And so it felt natural that what's going on around him is happening now. He doesn't have any perspective to look back on it.
And why would you... Can you remember the movement of fictionalising it? Can you remember why that boundary crossed?
I think I crossed the boundary from non-fiction to fiction reasonably early on. So I was working from a couple of memoirs. For obvious reasons, there are very few first-hand accounts of what happened in the three camps. There's a handful of them because there were only just under 400 survivors, of whom, you know, maybe half a dozen wrote about it. Two of those are really wonderful, and they were both situated in the same camp, which is Starobelsk camp. And I was incredibly influenced by these memoirs. They were well written and they were humane, and what came out of them were these personalities of the fellow prisoners of the people who were writing the memoirs. So one of them was an artist called Joseph Chapsky, who's very well known in Poland, and the other one is a guy called Bronisław Winarski, who's not a natural writer necessarily, but whose point of view was incredibly humane and humorous. And so they both built up for me a really vivid picture of life in the camp. And what I became more and more fascinated by was the idea that what sets the Katyn massacre apart from so many other dreadful things that happen is the fact that the prisoners themselves had absolutely no inkling of what awaited them. The NKVD went to extraordinary lengths to conceal their intentions from the prisoners. And in fact, it's arguable that they didn't even have murderous intentions for most of the time that the prisoners were there. It's not known at what precise point it was decided to kill them. The camps were mainly for interrogation. They wanted to gain intelligence from the prisoners, and they were also interested in conversion. They were interested in people that they could persuade to the communist cause.
How does that make it hard to continue in non-fiction?
So when I was reading the memoirs, the picture that it built up for me was a very vivid portrayal of life in the camp, and I was very struck by the fact that the prisoners had no idea why they were in the camp, or obviously they had no inkling of what was going to happen to them right up to the day when they were taken from the camps to be killed. The secret police went to the most extraordinary lengths to make them believe they were going home. So the perspective of history and the perspective of a lot of the non-fiction works about Katyn is always about the death, and it's always about the crime and the suppression of the crime. And from a Polish perspective, that's very understandable. At the same time, I felt that the result of that was this incredible weightiness when dealing with the subject that sometimes obscured the personalities of the people in the camp and the reality of who they were and what their existence was like. And very early on, it became my aim to achieve, if I could, a kind of resurrection of these characters. So what I was really interested in was their lives, not their deaths. And as I gleaned these little mini portraits from the very sparse memoirs that I had, it started becoming obvious to me that actually what I needed to do was create that world. In a way, I would see it more as dramatising rather than fictionalising. And I spent a long time trying to find who would be my protagonist, because I felt very sort of in the shadow of these two main memoirists. And then at one point I came upon an unpublished, very brief memoir by a young doctor, which I found online. And it was a 20-page account in Polish, which I translated. And as soon as I read it, I thought, this is it. This gives me the perspective. And he is the character that is more than anyone else. He's been changed and fictionalised, and so I changed his name. Whereas a lot of the other characters, if they are not invented, which most of them aren't, I've kept their real names, and I've based their characteristics on sometimes what might be two or three lines in a memoir, and then I've developed the character So that was a process. It was really about trying to bring to life these characters and allow them to kind of breathe and allow them to exist without that awful overshadowing that you have when you know what's going to happen.
Because it's such an appalling thing. What do you think is at the core of your wanting to write about it? I mean, sort of anger or...
Not at all. A lot of people would say, oh gosh, it's so heavy, it's so... Did you not get very depressed? And I suppose I go back to this idea that I became really fascinated by the lives of these men. And there's a 7-month period when they're in this camp where they have a sort of really extraordinarily rich life. And you have this group of people who are highly educated, professional men. They're doctors, lawyers, writers, architects, engineers, military people, that men who have a very active intellectual life. And so when they were put into this very strange camp, which wasn't as extreme as being in a labour camp, so they weren't physically suffering as you would if you had been sent to Siberia, the constant factor of their lives were these nocturnal interrogations conducted by the NKVD, which again were not violent, but which were mentally very exhausting and draining for them. There was a certain amount of physical work that they had to do. They had to rebuild their own camp. And of course, because they had engineers and architects and people who understood about these things, they actually set to rebuilding the camp with extraordinary kind of dedication and professionalism. And that I found very interesting. And they delivered lectures to each other from memory. So they would talk about their favourite subjects and they would recite poetry and talk about engineering and all of these things. And I just found this completely fascinating. And so, no, I never felt weighed down by it at all.
How did you feel about, or what did you think about the fact that people just here didn't know about it?
Yes, well, certainly I do. I just want to tell people about it. So I think I am just one of those people that likes to communicate things, and I want to tell stories that I find interesting, and I love history, and I become very passionate about a story, particularly if I feel that people don't know it. So I just want to tell, if British people are not aware, and certainly young people are not aware of what this story is, then I'm really keen to tell them about it, not out of anger, because that's not my anger to have, because, you know, I'm not Polish. I have a connection to it, but I wasn't oppressed by it in the way that many people were in Poland, so I don't feel it in that way. But I think it is an extraordinary illustration in the fact that you can have a lie that lasts for 50 years and a lie that's a state-sponsored one. I think actually right now, in this moment in time, I think that's a really, really interesting thing to think about, and about the personal cost to individuals who are affected by that, of what it's like to live in a society where the official version of things is not the truth.
That was Jane Rogojska in conversation with Frances Burns. You can find out more about Jane on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 198, which was recorded and produced by Frances Burns. Coming up in episode 199, Chris Arthur speaks with Cherise Saywell about the essay as a multifaceted and heretical form, the notion of a dangerously failed piece of work, and the encouraging fact that if you can find the objects that speak to you, essays will follow. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.